Today I'm going to be talking about what Marxists say about Parliament. And for a lot of people who want to see a better world, Parliament can seem as it's a source of power in our society, that we can get elected into Parliament, that you know other people can get elected into Parliament, and this is the way that we can really fight for progressive change. And even that, you know, for people who recognise that, you know, the representatives in Parliament at the moment aren't really doing that at the moment, all we need to do is to get better people into Parliament, because really Parliament is where it's at. This is where progressive change happens. And that, that socialists who basically fight for revolution are just utopian, that it's more realistic to try to change the institutions that we have today, and this is how we're going to get a better world. So understanding that the role of Parliament is actually in sustaining capitalism, not getting rid of it, and that rather than as some body that stands above society, that can legislate for progressive change, it is actually an instrument used to protect the existing power. And, you know, this helps to explain some of the things that we see happening in Australia and around the world today, basically why all governments, whether they're conservative, whether they call themselves social democrats or Labor-type parties, are basically scum. Why even those with good intentions who might have started out with some actual principles end up selling out, like Peter Garrett. Why governments, even those who are supposed to be better, who are supposed to be for workers, who are supposed to be for progressive change, pretty much help enforce the same right-wing agenda as the conservatives. So parliaments, along with the rest of the apparatuses of the state, arose historically with capitalism in order to serve a very specific purpose. They exist to administer the affairs of the capitalists operating within their borders, including regulating and legitimising exploitation, enforcing private property rights, and pursuing the interests of local capitalists overseas through military means, diplomacy, while at the same time giving the system a veneer of democratic accountability. And the power that Parliament has as well has very strict limitations. Because bosses own and control the productive resources and the vast majority of wealth in society, they basically hold clout over and above that of Parliament. As, you know, a 19th century shipping magnate, Cornelius Vanderbilt, succinctly put it, law, what do I care about law? Ain't I got the power? So this power ensures basically the loyalty of elected representatives, and where this fails can basically be superseded by the economic power of the capitalist class. And besides that, what little democracy that we do have, the right to vote, the small level of accountability that public officials do have, the right to voice political opposition, hold conferences like Marxism, was not brought about through Parliament. The right to vote was not won by voting. It was fought for by ordinary people against those in power, those who are very similar to the representatives in the Labor and Liberal governments today. And I think the radical historian Howard Zinn summed it up very nicely and perfectly when he said, "Democracy does not come from the top, it comes from the bottom. The mutinous soldiers, the angry women, the rebellious Native Americans, the working people, the agitators, the anti-war protesters, the socialists and the anarchists, dissenters of all kinds, the troublemakers. Yes, the people who have given us what liberty and democracy that we have." So it was not those parliamentarians or so-called defenders of democracy that are actually responsible for the rights that we have today. And we defend these reforms, the right to vote, the right to politically organise. You know, we don't just sit around, you know, at election time saying it doesn't matter, you know, in the here and now, it doesn't matter what reforms we have, those kind of things. You know, we never want to see the Liberals get into government, for example. But we recognise that these reforms were not the product of the people in Parliament. They were the product of the struggles of ordinary people. Okay, so Marx, Karl Marx, a famous people might have heard of him, the founder of Marxist politics, described Parliament as the best political shell for capitalism. Capitalism is a worldwide economic system of gross inequality. The most important groups governing our lives are the ones actually we don't get to elect. The CEOs of the banks, of the major corporations, the multinationals. Having accumulated vast amounts of wealth, they have translated this wealth into social power. The profits that these corporations make are actually produced by the labour of millions, billions of workers, but the power that this wealth creates stays in the hands of these parasitic minorities. Exploitation is therefore an inbuilt feature of capitalism, and if we lived in a real democracy, I think people would vote to change that, to get rid of exploitation. But pretty much the history of capitalism so far, no party has gone to an election where we could actually vote on whether we would like to be exploited or not. And so the capitalists, or the ruling class, get to make, completely undemocratically, the decisions that affect the lives of billions. How things are produced, who gets a job, who gets a house, who gets access to clean drinking water, access to life-saving medications, all these things, all these decisions that affect basically 90% of our lives are completely beyond the limits of Parliament. And so why still do people see Parliament as a source of power, or have illusions in Parliament, or, you know, just getting into Parliament is the way that we can actually have an impact on some of these things? And I think there's a few arguments, a few, I guess, common sense arguments about why people think the Parliament is where social change happens. And I think one of them is that people think that capitalism and democracy is synonymous, that capitalism equals democracy. You know, we get choice, we get Parliament, those kind of things. But actually, capitalism exists in places where even there is no parliamentary democracy, that the so-called free market sits very happily besides with dictatorships, despots, authoritarian monarchs. You know, we are seeing today that these dictatorships around the world, we heard some of the inspiring stories from last night, are being challenged. But also the so-called democratic face of capitalism is wearing thin. In places where it's not compulsory to vote, in America, for example, barely a third of the population does. And people around the world have abandoned social democratic parties, Labour-type parties, not because voters are more right-wing or they love conservatives or anything like that, but because basically they are fed up with the sellouts. And as well, with the onset of the economic crisis, what has the response been of governments around the world? Both dictatorships and democratic governments have basically responded in the same way, bailing out the capitalists of their own country and austerity for everyone else. That no matter what kind of shell capitalism has, it still defends the interests of the ruling class. Another argument that people say to defend Parliament is that, you know, the problem is not the institution itself, but the problem is the two-party system, or, you know, the major parties. They're the problem. We need some kind of alternative to them, who are progressive, who won't sell out. And, you know, this is really the way forward. But even parliamentary parties that have emerged to challenge the existing major parties, supposedly offering an alternative to their right-wing agenda, have disappointed. And I think one of the best examples is the Liberal Democrats in Britain. People heard of them, equivalent in a lot of ways to the Greens here, pitched themselves as, you know, the third party alternative with progressive politics. And just before the last election in Britain, famously went around to university campuses getting their pictures taken with big pledges saying, you know, not only will we not increase university fees, but we will fight to have them abolished. And so for those who don't happen, I'm sure you can guess what happened next. They joined. After the election, they joined government with the Tories, which are basically like the Liberals here, except on speed. And not only did they not fight to abolish university fees, they voted to triple university fees. And in the face of some of the biggest student demonstrations in generations. So, and a lot of people at those demonstrations were Lib Dem, or former Liberal Democrat voters. So I think, yeah, that kind of blows the argument out of the water. And finally, I think one of the other main arguments as well is that we need better people in Parliament. Like, it's, you know, we need to get rid of, well, we heard all the arguments before, like, we need to get rid of Howe, we need a Labour government in. Okay, Kevin Rudd, he's Labour, but, you know, he's a right-wing Christian, we need to get someone from the left of the Labour Party into the government. But I think, and yeah, this case in Australia, that we actually have this kind of, you know, the example, or the, you know, picture of that alternative, the Gillard, an atheist in a de facto relationship from the left of the Labour Party, is actually just as homophobic as Abbott, people have seen that, you know, in response to a question about same-sex marriage, she told people to read their Bible stories. Just as racist as Pauline Hanson, her East Timor solution was given a big tick of approval from Hanson. And, you know, just as anti-union as Howard, maintaining the draconian ABCC, which basically treats construction workers like terrorists, and basically maintaining most of Howard's work choices. So you don't even have to really have a Marxist understanding to see that those who enter Parliament, even some of them with the rosiest of intentions, end up selling out. You don't have to be a Marxist to see that politicians don't actually even act on what the people who elect them want to see happen. We have so many issues just in Australia today, the issue of same-sex marriage that the majority of people support, the issue of troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan that the majority of people want, even the perennial issue of actual money being spent on social services like health and education. Even though these are popular things, the government wholeheartedly does not support them. And also, I think you don't have to be necessarily a Marxist to see that it's not just about individuals in these positions of power or that political parties are rotten, but it's something about the institution itself. And so Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto explain that under capitalism, the bourgeoisie, oh, but being a Marxist helps you understand why these things happen. So Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto explain that under capitalism, they say the bourgeoisie, which is the capitalist class, has at last, since the establishment of modern industry and of the world market, conquered for itself in the modern representative state exclusive political sway. And that the executive of the modern state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie. And Lenin, a Russian revolutionary who was instrumental in the Russian Revolution there in 1917, said that Parliament is where we get to decide once every few years which member of the ruling class is to repress and oppress the people through Parliament. This is the real essence of bourgeois parliamentarianism. So to fully understand what they mean by this, that Parliament exists to manage capitalism in the interests of the capitalists, that it's not some neutral body that can be used against the exploiters and oppressors of society, it is important to understand that Parliament is just one aspect of the capitalist state. Lenin, again, in his groundbreaking work, The State and Revolution, published after the Russian Revolution, basically demolishes the idea that the state is some neutral body standing above social classes, demolishes the idea that the Parliament can be captured and used in the interests of ordinary people. He argues that the state and all its institutions, which includes things like the cops, the military, the education system, the legal system, and Parliament, exist as a means for one class, the ruling class, to maintain its dominance over the rest of us. He says, "The state is a product and manifestation of the irreconcilability of class antagonisms. The state arises where, when, and insofar as class antagonisms objectively cannot be reconciled. And conversely, the existence of the state proves that the class antagonisms are irreconcilable. The state is an organ of class rule, an organ for the oppression by one class of the other. It is the creation of order, which legalizes and perpetuates this oppression by moderating the conflicts between the classes." And by this, Lenin means, as I stated before, the Parliament cannot legislate away exploitation, cannot legislate the disgusting barbarity and logic of capitalism. He is saying the way the state is organized, all its institutions are geared towards maintaining this, maintaining capitalism. You know, maintaining exploitation, maintaining stability, maintaining property rights, maintaining a good business environment for domestic capitalists. You know, the state does not exist of the people, for the people, by the people, but is run and managed in the interests of a tiny minority. And I've got a great quote here as well that I really like from Albert Einstein, who, you know, granted is a genius, but he recognised this about capitalism, you know, that this is the kind of system that it is, that even where people have won democratic freedoms, you know, the right to votes and regular elections, this doesn't change the nature of the system. And he also puts nicely the relationship between the politicians and the ruling class. And so he says, "The enormous power of the capitalist class cannot be effectively checked even by a democratically organized political society. By this, he means Parliament. This is true since the members of legislative bodies are selected by political parties, largely financed or otherwise influenced by private capitalists, who for all practical purposes separate the electorate from the legislator. The consequence is that the representatives of the people do not in fact sufficiently protect the interests of the underprivileged sections of the population. Moreover, under existing conditions, private capitalists inevitably control, directly or indirectly, main sources of information, press, radio, education. It is thus extremely difficult, and indeed in most cases quite impossible, for the individual citizen to come to objective conclusions and make intelligent use of their political rights. So those who make it into Parliament have to please the real rulers of our society, to whom the party leaders swear loyalty. Politicians rule for the rich. This includes the mining companies, the banks, other captains of industry. The mass media, itself a series of capitalist enterprises, intervenes readily to set the perimeters of what is deemed acceptable and what is not. These are the forces in society with real power. So even if by chance a political party that did want to genuinely change things for the better did get into Parliament, the ruling class could simply rally around its most trusted state institutions, for example, the police, the army, the courts, and the vast state bureaucracy, against Parliament if necessary. So the ALP and others like them around the world rule for the rich because they are committed to capitalism. They accept the capitalist social order and do what is necessary to make it flourish. There is no way you could ever become government if that was not your project. And besides, as I said before, all the spheres of the state involved with the day-to-day running of the system, like the police, the courts, the military, even sometimes the parliamentarians themselves, are very happy to dispense with these democratic niceties that people have fought for if they do not like what the government is doing. So even if socialists did win a majority in Parliament, for example, the ruling class would use any and all means it could to stop them usurping that ruling class power. And we've seen this a few times in history, which I'm going to go through a bit later. Rosa Luxemburg, another Marxist, a German revolutionary around during World War I, it was clear that even if socialists were able to achieve a majority in Parliament, this would not signal the victory of socialism. She says, "In this society, the representative institutions, democratic in form, are in content the instruments of the interests of the ruling class. This manifests itself in a tangible fashion in the fact that as soon as democracy shows the tendency to negate its class character and become transformed into an instrument of the real interests of the population, the democratic forms are sacrificed by the bourgeoisie and its state representatives." And so this is not just some theoretical debating point between those who support getting into Parliament and those who see winning reforms as happening outside of Parliament. You know, what would happen if we got better people in? Just say, for example, there was this, magical person who didn't sell out, who got all the way to the top, who was Prime Minister and actually wanted to institute general reforms. It's been actually the bitter historical experience of the workers' movement internationally. Chile is one example, which I'll go through a bit later. But in many countries, China, Saudi Arabia, Egypt and Tunisia until very recently, and many others, capitalism and the market go hand in hand with these dictatorships, military, monarchic and one-party rule. Democracy, even bourgeois democracy, is a luxury that the ruling class is not willing to afford. And so, yeah, the example that illustrates this perfectly is Chile in the 70s. In Chile in 1970, a left-wing reformist government of Salvador Allende came to power proposing radical reforms for workers and even socialism. Chilean bosses and military heads keenly sensed that the growing confidence and combativeness of the working class following Allende's victory was something that they should be afraid of. They had no qualms about sacrificing parliamentary democracy when it looked like their interests were threatened. And so in September 1973, General Pinochet launched a military coup with support of the entire Chilean ruling class and the American ruling class to bring down the Allende government, smash the workers' movement, and establish a dictatorship. Allende himself was killed, along with 30,000 workers and left-wing activists. And even while much less violent than this, obviously military coups, people who know anything about the world today, are kind of a fact of life in a lot of places. These events actually had a parallel right here in Australia in the 70s as well. And this was the Kerr coup of 1975. So we saw the democratically elected Labor Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, who was by no means any description of socialist, was actually from the hard right of the party. But he was sacked by the Queen-appointed Governor-General, this unelected official. So the reason this happened is that Whitlam fell out of favour with the Australian ruling class for not driving down workers' wages fast enough, as the post-war boom came to an end and an economic crisis set in. The ruling class orchestrated a crisis atmosphere by withdrawing investment. The media went nuts attacking the government. And the Liberals, faithful lapdogs of the Australian bosses, blocked the budget in the Senate. So it came to pass that the unelected, unaccountable and mostly unknown Australian ruling class was able to get rid of democracy. And all of this was completely legal, by the way. But there were mass protests and strikes and demonstrations against the sacking by workers in the unions. But thanks to the leadership of both the Labor Party and the unions, who do see and who do attempt to capture Parliament, the protest movement was called off. Workers were literally told to cool off and just wait to exercise your rights at the ballot box. And, of course, the Liberals got into power and Labor and the workers' movement suffered a crushing defeat. So Parliament and parliamentary democracy can be easily dispensed because it is not where real power in society lies. It lies with the capitalist class, and they tolerate our right to vote so long as it does not challenge their right to rule. And we have another example of this just last year, the mining tax. Kevin Rudd tried to introduce a tax on the mining company's super profits, a tax that was well overdue, a tax that was initially, especially, widely supported. And what happened? The mining companies declared all-out war, launched a media campaign, threatened to stop investment projects, threatened workers' jobs, and eventually got the democratically elected Prime Minister sacked, this time by his own party, the parliamentarians themselves. And so I think this goes to the heart as well about the about where power lies, and the economic power that capitalist class have means that they do have this power to dispense with democracy at will. So, like, you know, if I wrote a letter to the government saying, you know, I think I'm paying too much tax, I would like to not pay any more tax, you know, I be lucky if I get a polite response back saying, you know, that's nice and, you know, good on you. Yeah. But if Andrew Forrest, you know, the head of BHP, if you're him, not only do you get taxed less, you get to bring down the democratically elected leader of the government, and actually the government gives you a whole bunch of tax breaks. So the mining tax debacle was the perfect illustration, the economic and social power of the ruling class, which is not subject to any democratic measures whatsoever, and in a matter of days can bring down democratically elected governments. And as well, just on the level of individuals, you know, one of the tenets of democracy, one person, one vote, that's how it's equal, that's how it's democratic. Well, even though I get one vote and Gail Kelly, the CEO of Westpac, gets one vote, we really don't have the same impact on what the politicians do. You know, it may seem like a simple common sense statement to say that Gail Kelly, the CEO of a major bank, has more social power than I do. But basically, if you can see that, it contradicts the very notion that Parliament equals democracy. A person with the same rights as me at the ballot box has more political power than me, really gets to the heart of where power in society lies. And really, there is nothing inherently democratic about the capitalist system. Parliament can give it that veneer in some places, an illusion of democracy where, you know, we can feel like we do have some kind of say, get a vote once every few years. But really, those with real power to impact what happens in this world are willing to even to get rid of our illusions of democracy when it is not in their interest. And besides that, and most importantly, that most of the important decisions in the world are completely off limits to any democratic control whatsoever. How things are produced, how the education system is run, whether there are jobs, whether we should spend billions and trillions on war, killing other workers around the world. We basically live under an economic dictatorship, a dictatorship of the rich. And that is something that that Parliament will never legislate away. The main job of Parliament is to, in general, maintain stability, maintain the status quo, let business run smoothly, so those with power can continue to make the decisions that affect 90% of our lives, without us having any input whatsoever. And so just to sum up, Parliament is an institution whose very being is designed to preserve capitalism and all the inequalities that flow from that. Parliament is basically where progressive politics go to die. It is the graveyard of socialists and those with any desire to change the world for the better. If we do want to see real change, real reforms, and actually an end to war, oppression, and exploitation, Parliament is the last place where we should look. Just a few examples of some of the great reforms that have been won in recent history. The Vietnam War, for example, was not ended by all the pro-war politicians sitting in government at the time. It was won by the ordinary Vietnamese fighting back. It was won by the soldiers resisting. It was won by the activists on the streets demanding an end to it. Women's rights to vote was won by street marches, the courageous campaign of women around the world, and even by the threat of potentially revolutionary struggles. This is how women's right to vote was won, not through Parliament. And even where we do have electoral victories, it doesn't happen just through what the politicians do. For example, the ousting of John Howard. This was not because people were whipped into a frenzy by Kevin, 07 or loved the Labour Party. It was the Your Rights at Work campaign. It was the fact that Work Choices was an attack on the rights of the majority of people in Australia, and the unions actually organised and mobilised people to launch a campaign against him. And this was the basis of kicking out the Liberals. So any time that we have seen a glimpse to an alternative to capitalism, a world run democratically in the interest of the majority, it was most definitely not through some legislative debate. It was by workers, students, minorities organising themselves and coming up against the state, up against Parliament, and creating their own institutions of genuine democracy, of economic democracy. So capitalism is a class society dominated primarily by those who own and control large amounts of wealth. These are the corporate CEOs, the bankers, media barons, and their allies like the generals and the politicians. Their system is geared around the profit motive rather than human need, and Parliament is part and parcel of this. And I've just got a little tiny quote here from an American socialist, James P. Cannon, which I like. It says that the socialist task is not to deny democracy, but to expand it and make it more complete. So how can we have real democracy under capitalism unless and until the mass of people can take control of the industries where they work, take control of all the technology, natural resources, and huge potential of collective human labour, and organise the economy to benefit everyone? This sort of economic democracy is the starting point of socialism, and it's why we don't look to Parliament to see these things. We look to the struggle of ordinary people around the world, the struggles that we're actually seeing happening right now today, and this is what socialists fight for, and so this is the Marxist explanation of Parliament.